8:02, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Sitting in this morning for Cecil and Celeste, I'm Lisa Loving. We're live in Studio 2 on the line with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. Dan, thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, good morning, Lisa.
In January, Cop Watch released a report about law enforcement use of force around the state, but not one media outlet covered the story. And Dan, I just thank you extra for being with us today. And I'm not going to waste any time saying some parts of this situation are simple, Dan, but overall, it makes my head spin. So I might need to double back on some of these issues because I find them so incredible. But I want to talk, what was the report that you sent out in January? Let's just start there.
So what we've been doing for a couple of years now is gathering up all the deadly force incidents in the state of Oregon and sending them to the Attorney General's office, because there was a law that was passed in 2007. It was called Senate Bill 111 that required the state to report on all, they only have to report on all deaths caused by law enforcement, but we include the times when the officers shot at them and the person didn't die, or if they used their vehicles in deadly force and the person didn't necessarily die, that we know of. And you know, we keep finding new stuff there all the time, but that was the list that we sent out. And at the time we sent it, we had identified 196 incidents over the course of the years, 192 incidents, and we have since discovered 8 more. So it's actually a total since from 2010 to the end of 2017, a total of exactly 200 incidents right now in our database.
Okay. And I want to say, continue that thought. What were all the things that SB 111 did? I feel like it also required the Department of Justice to occasionally report. Can you make a short list for us of all the things that law was supposed to have done?
Well, what it did was it required every law enforcement agency in the state and every district attorney in the state to come up with a plan about what to do when there's a deadly force incident, which is in a way unfortunate because in Portland we had come to the point where we got the district attorney to put every use of deadly force by police, at least when they use a firearm and strike somebody, that's another story, but to hold a grand jury to see if it was legally within the law. Other counties can make a different plan where they don't have to hold one, and sometimes the district attorney just says, I think it was fine, and that's it, and there's no even community check of any kind. Now, in some ways, that doesn't matter because in Portland, there's only been one indictment of an officer since 1969, and it was not for a death in custody. It was a guy who loaded his shotgun, his less lethal shotgun, with live rounds and wounded somebody permanently. And that person was indicted and never prosecuted because he
killed himself.
Suicide. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the so the law enforcement agencies and the district attorney were supposed to hold community forums explaining to people what the process is. Now, I think that's particularly important here in Portland because every couple of years, as we just had last month, we have a controversial shooting, and people are rightfully outraged. And the DA or somebody should come out to the community and explain what's going on and be forced to listen to what the community's concerns are. Unfortunately, they felt that what the law meant is we have to hold a couple community forums. Once we do, we're done. And they wrapped everything up in, I can't even remember what year it was now. I think it was 2009 or 2010 here in Multnomah County, and that they did 2 forums, and that was it. So there was a page that was on the state's website, which has since disappeared, that had links to every county's plan. I think you can still find that if you go to archive.org and look it up. But that's the gist of it. Is that everybody's supposed to come up with a plan, and it's supposed to be passed by the various municipalities. So Portland had to consider this. The city council had to consider this before it was approved by the DA. And then the state was supposed to be publishing this data every year. And so we started this project. Actually, our reporter for the Scanner
That would be me.
You, helped us plot out all the shootings and deaths in, I think it was 2014 and 2015.
It's like 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, and we found, like, it's all over the state.
It's really shocking. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was one of the reasons, if you just tuned in, this is More Talk Radio. I'm Lisa Loving, sitting in for Cecil Celeste. We're live on the phone with Dan Handelman. We're talking about what the hell, state of Oregon. You're supposed to be tracking law enforcement use of force and then submitting data about it, and they're not doing it at all.
Well, no, that's not true.
Okay, good. Debate with me.
That's part two of our story.
All right. But let me ask you this, though. We're going to get there, but we're saying law enforcement use of force. We're not saying police accountability. Talk about which law enforcement jurisdictions have been implicated in this so far.
Well, that's a good point, actually. So it is state, anybody that's employed by the state. That includes the Oregon State Police and the sheriff's deputies in every county.
Then shows up the FBI.
It does not include the FBI.
Right?
And it does not include U.S. Marshals, who have been involved in several of these incidents, but that those incidents that where local law enforcement fired their guns do show up in the database.
And it's a big deal with the Floyd Finicum shooting. So all this stuff just hits at the same time, and there's all these pieces of it, and trying to figure out the policy piece and who's supposed to be in charge, it really is a big deal.
Oh, that's always a question when there's multiple law enforcement agencies involved. So you mentioned Lavoie Finicum. So let's get to the second part of the story. So we've been publishing this data every year. We actually skipped 2017 because it was just too much going on, and we did 2 years worth this in January of this year. So we did 2016 and 2017, and sent the letter to the Attorney General. We didn't hear anything back, and so we're just okay. Here we go again. They're ignoring us. And then a reporter from KABU called to talk to me about SB 111 and said, you know, they have the data up now. I'm like, what? So I went up online, and you can actually find it. I can give you the URL. You can write it down and give it out to your listeners if they want. It's at justice.oregon.gov and then /death-incident, all run together, /home/search. And if you go to that page, you can see the cases that they have gotten reports on. Now, there are only 82 listed, and at least four of those are duplicates. And they started in 2008, which is the first year that was required. They started posting data about the year 2008. It should be really clear, they did not start posting these data until very late December of 2016. So this is 9 years after the law passed requiring them to do this, and after we'd been sending it for 3 years. Why the Attorney General's office didn't contact Portland Cop Watch and say, dear Portland Cop Watch, thank you for reminding us of our duty to post these data. We have now done it. I don't know. It just seems like it would be a common courtesy since we've been doing all this work for them for years.
You know, and here's another thing, and I'm not going to say what I was almost going to say, but I feel like Democrats have been in charge of these institutions. It's Democratic leadership that's sort of shutting this down, and maybe I'm just being too political, and it is an election season, but I have issues with that, too. It's liberal people. It's not, you can't say Republican sheriffs are shutting this stuff down at the state.
We don't know what it was. I mean, I think a lot of the excuse for the discontinuation of community forums and whatnot is lack of funding. It's an unfunded mandate. And I just find it hard to believe that they don't have enough money to hire somebody to make sure that the law enforcement agencies are posting this every time there's a death. There are 25 a year. I mean, that's a lot. That's too many. Any one death is too much. But when you think about it, that's about two a month. And so somebody out there can be looking at the websites for news, you know, polling the different counties and saying, hey, has anybody died this month? And then just posting the stuff. But that's not what's been happening.
It's, I mean, again, and this is the part that gets me. I don't always buy into the political party thing. I don't. I think that those liberal, conservative, I think that those terms are obsolete. So who's... why can't we do this one basic thing? I mean, lives hang in the balance. And I want to say something controversial and say, when police and law enforcement kill people, it hurts them too. They go into a tailspin individually. A lot of this has been well documented. It hurts them and it hurts us. So where is, you know, why can't we get behind this? I do have to come right out and say, this is KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Lisa Loving, sitting in for Cecil and Celeste. We're live on the phone with Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. We're talking about statewide use of force by law enforcement. And I'm going to open up the phone lines and say, are you active for police and law enforcement accountability? Or did you go to the Keaton Otis commemoration this past weekend? Call us, 503-231-8187. Share your project with us, share your ideas, and help us get plugged in. Help us all get plugged in together. So, Dan, we're talking about Senate Bill 111 that was passed in 2007, more than 10 years ago. And Cop Watch, now I came to your project. You had already gathered this data, right?
Yeah.
Where did you get the data?
Just from scanning newspapers and the web. It's out there, and sometimes occasionally mainstream television news will show a clip, and I'll write it down as I try to watch the TV news every day, even though it's not healthy for your brain, but just to see if the Portland police have been involved in anything. And sometimes I'll mention a shooting in another city. But I do want to add something too. You just talked about Keaton Otis, and it's reminded me one of the things about the data that have already been published. Okay, two things about the data. First of all, I told you that they had 82 incidents listed, including four duplicates. When you screen that down to just 2010 till 2017, which are the years that we published our data for, they are missing at least 47 deaths in their database right now, at least 47. So that is a large number.
Is it one-third of the total, perhaps?
It's very close to one-third. There's actually been 100.
Come on, y'all.
there's been 112 deaths, which is outrageous.
It makes my head spin. You know, Dan, I've had jobs, and when I make a mistake that skews one-third of the data in a project I have to do at work, I get in trouble. And I look at these officials, and I just, who is in charge?
Know. It's about 42% of them are missing. Yeah, so there's quite a few. Yeah, I know, right? So, but we have that list, and we've been sending it to them every year. So here's the thing, though. I don't know who has been entering these. It's not always the law enforcement agency that caused the death. Some of the most prominent deaths in Portland were entered in by the Attorney General's office. And the listing for Aaron Campbell, who listeners might remember, was shot in the back by a police sniper in 2010. He had been suicidal. Somebody called the police. They came in, and they told him to put his hands over his head, and he did. And then they shot him in the back with a beanbag gun. He went to reach down to the small of his back where they hit him, and the sniper shot him because he thought he was reaching for a gun. They said, oh, there was no gun. He was unarmed at the time he was shot. This caused a lot of controversy. The narrative that's posted on the Attorney General's website says that he pulled a gun out of his waistband.
It is literally the opposite of what actually happened. Can I be real for a second? I have to jump in this one. As a news editor at the Scanner newspaper, I covered Aaron Campbell's case like a blanket. And his brother had died of a heart problem that day. He was suicidal, and his family called for a welfare check.
Yep.
He did everything the police, this wonderful officer named Quackenbush, he was the, he was the negotiator. He talked Aaron Campbell out of his apartment. Quackenbush did his job. He did a great job. And then Campbell was shot, attacked by a dog, and tased. He died with a dog biting him. The police report is like, it's like, what is it, 500 pages. It's shocking what happened there. And was it Freshour that shot him?
Yeah. Officer Ron Freshour, and he was actually fired, but then reinstated because the police union went to bat for him, which is pretty typical in the few cases over the many years where officers have lost their jobs or gotten disciplined after a shooting.
In Oregon, in other states, we're seeing that officers are being charged. they're being fired and charged. So I'm so curious to see a multi-state analysis about the police officer or law enforcement union negotiations that help people get reinstated in jobs after they have a devastating violent incident. So I do have to say the number to call if you want to participate in this really deep conversation is 503-231-8187. Were you at the Keaton Otis commemoration this past weekend, or are you active for law enforcement accountability? We'd love to hear about your work and help us get plugged in. 503-231-8187. And I think we have a caller. Oh, we don't. Okay, great. So, Dan.
So to answer your question, I was at the Keaton Otis Memorial this weekend.
Yay.
It was very well attended. It was very sobering. There were several mothers of people who'd been killed by the police that were there, including a woman named Irene Kalonji, who started her own group called the Pacific Northwest Family Circle that includes other mothers of people who've lost loved ones to police violence. Now, Irene Kalonji's son was killed by the Clackamas County Sheriff's deputies in early 2016, and her son's death is not listed on the DOJ's website, the Oregon DOJ's website. It's as though he got erased from history. There are 47 of those cases. And Lavoie Finicum, who you talked about before, which is very high profile and highly controversial case where an Oregon State police officer shot and killed him and an FBI agent lied about whether or not he fired his gun at him. That case is also not listed, for example.
I'm breathing. I have to breathe thinking about that. Dan, let me back up and say, because you mentioned Keaton Otis, I think I saw where one of the officers who shot him was recently promoted by the new chief of police.
He wasn't promoted. He was just involved. He was just involved in another shooting. He was involved in the shooting inside the homeless shelter last month.
Is that what it was? Okay.
That's what it was.
Let's dig down into the Keaton Otis case for a moment, because every year since it happened, there's been monthly commemorations at the spot, which is near the Lloyd Center shopping mall, and then also bigger commemorations. Keaton Otis, now, help me remember this one. I feel like he was wearing a hoodie and driving down the street, and the police decided that they didn't like the way he looked. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, that is accurate. He's driving his mother's Toyota.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a May day, so yeah, the 8th anniversary just passed this weekend, and he was slouched in his seat driving his mother's Toyota, and they said he wouldn't look at them. I think in one narrative they said he wouldn't look at them. In another one, they said he was staring in his rearview mirror and kept staring at them. So I don't know which one it was. And then they said he looked like he could be a gangster, which is police code word for this guy's black. And oddly, the agency that comes in to review police shootings for Portland, the OIR group, said they didn't think this was racial profiling, which I just found to be an outrageous analysis. I mean, any way you slice it, when they look at a guy driving a nice car that they think he's not supposed to be in and say he could be a gangster, that is racial profiling, plain and simple.
I want to take it a second step and say, here was another one that I covered. And by the way, if you're out there listening right now and you're thinking, wow, this world, and this is so interesting to me, you can access these police reports. I want to strongly encourage people to stop what you're doing and dig into this stuff. You're paying for this, right? We're all paying for it. But Keaton Otis, those officers, they literally formed a circular firing squad around that car. And one of the officers was shot. And they're saying, they always said Keaton Otis shot him, but I always wondered about that. Like, I read that report too. That was another hundreds and hundreds of pages of report. And I don't really feel crystal clear about that case.
Yeah, well, a lot of people in the community agree with you and think that that was friendly fire, so to speak, if there is such a thing, where, that officer was hit by another officer's bullets. But the police have always said that Keaton Otis reached into the glove compartment of the car, pulled out a Crown Royal bag, somehow pulled the gun out of that bag, somehow shot this officer two times, and then the officers responded by shooting and killing him. 32 bullets were fired at him, 23 hit him, and that's how he died. He was having mental health issues, but really, even though that is part of the story, the overall story is this is racial profiling. Now, with his case, the DOJ's narrative says that Otis reached into the car and withdrew a firearm. And he was never out of the car until they dragged his body out after they had riddled it with bullets. And then they left him lying on the sidewalk for a long time. which is also another typical thing. And they also shot at him with a beanbag gun to make sure he wasn't, quote, faking it. These are just horrible, horrible things to do to a human being. And but the fact that our state DOJ, which is supposed to be reporting back to us what's going on, is just letting these incorrect narratives be posted on the web as the formal remembrance of how these people died is just shocking and horrible.
It is the public record. Hey, listeners, what are you doing? What are you doing right now? It is going to be a beautiful day. But give us a call. Are you active for law enforcement accountability? Or did you go to the Keaton Otis commemoration? Or do you have something important to share in this conversation? We're trying to actually shift this issue. You know, Portland has taken, this has become the national issue that's affecting everyone. And the number to call, 503-231-8187. What do you think should be done? Right? You know, it's funny, Dan, because I've been covering this issue now for decades. And I guess it's the place where you can see that the, I don't know, I guess I want to say capitalist systems or something like that, the unfriendly systems that squeeze us for money all the time, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where they've nailed some of the nails in, and we spin around, but we can't always shift this issue of the law enforcement accountability. And then in the city of Portland, Dan, we've been talking about this for, has it been 25 years? Has it been 30 years? How many years? And we're not dumb. We've done a lot. So what gives, Dan? What's the holdup? I gotta put it on the table.
Why are you putting this on me? I mean, this is
more about it, Dan.
How long did it take for women to get the right to vote in this country?
No, that's not a criticism of the activism. I'm saying.
No, I understand, but
we don't have it.
Slavery.
Well,
the problem is that we don't have the tipping point yet, and it, you know, a big boost for the movement came in 2014 with the unfortunate death of. Now I'm blanking on his name in Ferguson, Missouri, the shooting in Ferguson
Michael
that
Brown.
Caused. Yeah. Thank you. That generated outrage all over the country and really catapulted the Black Lives Matter movement to the forefront. And unfortunately, though, see, as and this is the problem, we're up against these giant institutions of mostly white men who say, "Oh, but now you're endangering police officers, and we don't want to do our jobs anymore because we're afraid that somebody's going to criticize us or, you know, try to hold us accountable." And they kind of turned the narrative around and made Black Lives Matter, and FBI literally now is saying Black Lives Matter are terrorists, which is outrageous and just ridiculous. So that's the kind of stuff we're up against.
Right, right.
Institutional racism and institutional power. And, you know, frankly, the reason Portland Cop Watch does the work we do is that we are part of Peace and Justice Works, which was founded in 1992, so it's 26 years now, and we see the local police as a reflection of our military, where the government extends its power and enforces its policies using violence. And that's what happens with wars overseas, and that's what happens here with the police.
Right. Dan, we have LJ on the line. LJ, what's going on,
man? Good morning, Lee. Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
I'm great. How about you?
You know, yet another day. All right. So here's the situation. Law enforcement and activists are adversaries. And when we approach, how can I put this, a problem in an adversarial way, we always come out the losers.
You mean we the people?
Yeah, we the people always always lose. And now law enforcement has evolved into paramilitary, as you can see by that demonstration that we had last August, mm-hmm. when the alt-right and the so-called Black Box Kids we've had some kind of confrontation downtown. The police and the alt-right worked together to squash the anti-fascist.
Like literally, like they we've got pictures of law enforcement. That was an interesting thing, LJ. Thank you for bringing that up. That's really interesting because we saw pictures in that demonstration of a law enforcement person who gave his zip ties to what seemed like a white supremacist who was helping him arrest someone. And everybody's like, wait a minute, is he a Nazi or is he fed? And so we can't
He's a deputy.
Right.
He was obviously deputized.
It's so interesting when you put it that way, like defining who's on what team or who is representing what interest based on the adversarial relationships. Now, because LJ, here's the thing that gets me. So I've been really lately getting in touch with my family roots, and they're all blue collar. Okay. Those cops, I'm going to put this out. Portland police are trained in a militaristic way, like boot camp. It goes back to what Dan said. They get trained by the state at this facility in the Salem area. And I mean, I feel as if I was facilitating a candidate forum here at KBOO a couple weeks ago, and the candidates kept saying, we want the police to be better trained. Those people are very well trained. What you want is for them to be differently trained. And I feel as if I remember years ago, I feel like Dan Handelman, I have a memory of CopWatch trying to get more of a handle on what the training involved. And you guys really got shut down on that. We were struggling about it. But Dan, I wonder, what's your take on the training?
Well, the thing is that Portland takes the training that gets done down in Salem at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and then they do additional training. And we haven't talked about yet that after Aaron Campbell's death, members of the community, particularly leaders of the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, where I sit on the steering committee of that group, but they called the U.S. Department of Justice to look at a pattern in practice that was going on around deadly force, particularly around African Americans. And the DOJ did an investigation and said, you're right, there's a pattern of deadly force, particularly against people with mental health issues, which itself is true, but the fact that they ignored the issue of the racism also it reflects that pattern we were talking about before.
And I feel like they mentioned the racism, but they were like, meh, in that report. That's my memory. They kind of went, yeah, racism, but I don't know.
Right. Well, what they said is that they couldn't prove that it was intentional, but I don't really understand how they could prove that the deadly force against people with mental health issues was intentional either. So it just boggles the mind. But you know, the point is that we have this DOJ agreement that has told police and reinforced these policies and trainings that the Portland police already had that said you can use less than the most amount of force that's allowed by the law. And this is one of the things that complicates this, that the Supreme Court ruled a long time ago in Graham versus Connor, a case that went before them, that the police can use what's a reasonable amount of force given the totality of the circumstances, and you can't sit there at 20/20 hindsight later saying this is what was reasonable because I'm sitting in my comfy chair now, and I'm not the police officer that was sitting there. So that put a real big dent in the ability to prosecute police, which is another reason why we've had fewer prosecutions. But it doesn't mean that we as a city can't make our own rules that say there's very limited time when you can use deadly force and then punish officers who go outside those bounds. Now, we haven't seen the results of that yet here in Portland, where they're supposed to be using it Part of the problem, I think, is that the U.S. DOJ themselves keeps ignoring the fact that most of the people being shot at by the police since they came to town have had mental health issues, and yet the police continue to shoot them unabated.
Mm. Hey, so we have Francis on the line. Francis, what's going on with you today?
Hello.
Hello.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that Keaton was a dear friend of my family's and that he grew up with my son. And a lot of the young people who knew Keaton honor him every day. And I was talking with one of my sons the other day who said that he and another friend of Keaton's, a day doesn't go by and they don't think about him. And they are young black men who, what breaks my heart is I've talked to young people who, young men, some in their 20s and some in their 30s, who have said to me that they are literally afraid to drive alone at night in the city of Portland because of these things that have happened, and they want to have someone with them. And that, to me, that's just heartbreaking. that young people feel that way in the United States of America in Portland, Oregon. One thing I would like to note is that Keaton and these young men were telling me that they honor him every day by being good men and by being good parents and by being the kind of man that they knew Keaton was. And it's, I would like to acknowledge the fact that the police also shot Keaton while he was being tasered. He was tased 3 times, once in the neck. And some kind of way he was able, as being tased, to, as you said, get a gun out of a Crown Royal bag in the glove compartment or wherever they said it was. And another incident that I would like you to talk about, if you want to, is Kendra James, because that one, to me, is, there's no question that she was unarmed. And the reason that she was allegedly going to be arrested was because of what they called a street warrant for attempt to possess. And I would like to know, I asked, at the time, there was a community forum and the police were there, and I asked the officer, what, the sergeant who was giving the forum, what is attempt to possess a controlled substance?
It sounds like being arrested on suspicion, you know what I'm saying? It sounds like a constitutional violation, just on its
exactly.
face.
Exactly. And it, well, he said, oh, I don't know, maybe she possessed some paraphernalia or something. He didn't even know. And I have often wondered if there really even was a street warrant for her arrest, because she had a history with the officers. Some of them knew her. And I also am aware of the fact that a lot of people that are drug addicted are put in positions where they'll be released from jail if they agree to help the police
inform on others.
Set up other people. Yes, exactly.
Classic system.
And that scenario was not, as far as I'm concerned, ever fully investigated. And the way that Kendra, a 21-year-old young woman, was killed, she was shot as she was trying to leave the scene and in the hip, and they let her lay on the interstate overpass on Skidmore Street and bleed to death. They thought she was faking. I read one of the reports. The officers thought she was faking. She'd just been shot, but they thought she was faking.
This was an issue with the Aaron Campbell shooting, actually, because I think sometimes people get shot, and then the police are afraid that if they go over there that they'll get shot. So they wait, and even if the person's completely incapacitated. And I know that in other jurisdictions and other parts of the country, this is something that's being eliminated as a police tactic or something like that. But it's a sense of these officers that are now robocopped up, and they're trained to be afraid for their lives from individual people who are unarmed in the community. And I'm always coming back to think of the Dora McCrae case, right? The woman who was the executive director of Loaves and Fishes, and she was put in a headlock and dragged out of her van by an officer who said that he thought she was going to kill him. She was 70 years old, I think, 68 years old. We have other callers. I love you, Frances. Thank you always for being part of this community and lending your voice. Just always want to thank you.
So, Lisa, can I just add that the 15th anniversary of Kendra James' death just passed a week ago on May 5th, and some people from Pacific Northwest Family Circle held a vigil for her on the overpass, the Skidmore overpass, where she was shot and killed. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there's a banner with her picture on it that's still there.
A new commemorative banner.
Go over there.
And that's on Northeast Skidmore on the overpass over the 5. Yeah. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm sitting in today for Cecil and Celeste. We're live on the phone with Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch, and we're talking about law enforcement use of force around the entire state of Oregon. And now we're kind of updating with some of our local stories. We've got Kristen on the line. What's going on?
Hey, I just wanted to say a big shout out to Dan for doing this work for so many decades. I dropped in the police accountability work with a tiny group called Empower Portland a little less than 2 years ago. And I just want to call out that anybody can do that in this town. Just drop into police accountability work and Dan and Portland Cop Watch just have this massive, you know, background of data and procedures and stuff to tap into that just makes, you know, makes things so much more effective. So thank you, Dan, for the work that you do. We appreciate you so much.
Well, thank you, Kristen.
All right.
I also wanted to call out one quick thing, if I may. I didn't get a chance to say this to City Council at the budget hearings recently, but we're looking at a really close connection between the funding for increased funding for neighborhood watches. I don't know if folks caught that in the original budget request, there was a request for an increase from 400 to 500 neighborhood watches in Portland. And that number just blew my mind, right? Because cops are asking for so much more money for more officers, saying that not because we have an increase in crime, but because they're having an increase in 911 calls. What's driving that, right? And I would argue that one of those big factors is that more folks are being trained by cops to be neighborhood watchers, and Commissioner Udilly will tell you that that's not how it is, but it certainly is. Read the signs. They say, we call law enforcement when we see suspicious activity, right? Talk about coded racism right there. So let's take a look at what's driving this increase in calls that's then driving the excuse for more police officers. We need to get that money into stuff like ONI's mediation program rather than more neighborhood watches. And let's all learn how to demilitarize this stuff ourselves. We don't have any excuse to say we need more officers because we get calls.
Kristen, and when you put that next to the factual errors, the really shocking factual errors of the so-called reporting system, it doesn't seem like a one-off. It doesn't seem like an accident. I just have to say, people need to
Absolutely.
Step up and be vigilant because, and not be paranoid about your everyday neighbor. You know, I just want to, say, meet your neighbors, make friends with them. Kristen, thanks for calling. We have other callers. Dan, did you want to respond to any of that?
Oh, no, I think that the pervasiveness of the police mindset is one of the things we have to really be worried about, especially in the age of Donald Trump, where there are all these foot soldiers that he has, like the Joey Gibson people, the alt-right people that was an earlier caller was referencing, who are out there trying to be cops and just reinforcing the state's power through violence and intimidation. So I think some people enter this, nobody wants their house broken into, nobody wants their children threatened or anything like that. But I think they enter into this relationship with the police without thinking about how they're helping reinforce these stereotypes and this violence. And I hope that when people do have their own neighborhood block watches, they also turn around to the police when something goes wrong and say, no, that's not what we asked you to do. We asked you to protect us. Not, for instance, in Laurelhurst last year, there was a shooting where a man was walking around supposedly pointing a toy gun around the neighborhood, and the police shot up the neighborhood. And the guy never fired the weapon, and he didn't get hit by any of the police bullets. A couple of houses and a boat trailer and boat were hit by the police bullets, and the city council just awarded over $50,000 to the two families who had property damage because of this. And this is the neighborhood where Nathan Thomas was killed in 1992.
See, I was going to bring that up.
Where he was being held hostage inside his own home, and the police killed both him and the hostage taker.
Shot through a window.
Well, they tried shooting through a window, but they shot the shots that killed the two of them were from the bottom of the stairway.
So let's continue with that. We do have another caller, but really quickly, I want to continue with that. So Nathan Thomas shooting, his family actually tried to do a restorative justice thing. I'm going to say a restorative justice thing with the police bureau. And they supported like creating some kind of system to recognize goodness within the police bureau. And Dan, am I remembering it correctly? They finally said no. Heck with that.
No, that's not what happened.
Good.
What they did was they forced the city to come up with a crisis intervention team, which is something that started in Memphis, Tennessee. It's called the Memphis Model, where some officers volunteer, get extra training about how to deal with people in mental health crisis, and are called out when there's an emergency. So listeners may not remember, but in 2001, there was somebody who was put, a day laborer, was put into a mental health hospital, even though he had epilepsy and not mental health issues, and he broke out of his room, and crisis intervention team officers came and calmed him down and put him back in the room. And then a few hours later, he broke out of the room again, and the crisis intervention team officers went off duty And so a regular officer showed up and ended up shooting and killing him. And then a few years later, so this is 2001, 2006, James Chassie was beaten to death by police in the street because they said they thought they saw him urinating, which was never proven. And then they started telling people around that he had drugs, even though he had a bag with breadcrumbs in it. The point is that he had mental health issues. And at that point, after years, when we said, why are you only giving a small handful of cops training about how to recognize mental illness and de-escalate, you should train them all. Magically, they found the money they said they didn't have and started training all the officers with 40 hours of the crisis intervention training. Unfortunately, when the DOJ came in, before the DOJ came in, what they did was then they disassembled the specialty team. So even though some cops are better at this than others, they didn't, because everybody had the training, they didn't say, okay, now we're going to dispatch these special officers. So the DOJ came in and said, you have to have enhanced crisis intervention officers who can call it in to these situations so they can handle it with their extra skills. So now there are some officers who get 80 hours of training, and that's what the McMurray-Thomas family's legacy is, that they forced the Portland to start this de-escalation. And we have seen some results from that, but I would say some at best, because we just had that incident in the homeless shelter where the man was obviously in a mental health crisis, and the police, Portland police officers, one sheriff's deputy, shot the man to death right in front of other civilians who were all at risk. And so they're obviously not learning all their lessons.
The part about Jose Mejia Pote case, he was shot to death in the psych facility. He was killed in the psych ward. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving, sitting in for Cecil and Celeste. More Talk Radio. We're live on the phone with Dan Handelman. We're talking about, now we're getting to the last quarter of the show. We're freewheeling discussion about police accountability, law enforcement accountability. I do have a few more questions I want to ask Dan, but we've got someone on the phone. Mike is on the phone. Mike, you are the soul of patience. Okay, what's going on with you today?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm always leery when I hear white people talking about police accountability. I think for white people, it's an academic exercise, because white people are not really affected by police brutality. I mean, Dylann Roof, you know, he walks in and kills five or six black people, they take him alive. All these different situations where white people do horrendous things, the police take them alive, like that guy that killed those students. But black people get killed on the flimsiest circumstances. And so I just don't think when white folks get involved in things like this, nothing is going to change. Also, one last thing, you know, They don't have a sanctuary city for black. They don't have a sanctuary state for black people. They don't consider black people, worthy of saving. You don't see churches coming out and trying to change the situation. You know, the churches are quiet. So, you know, this is a systematic extermination of black people that's been going on ever since they brought us here. And I think one of the reasons why black people are systematically exterminated, because when white people look at us, we remind them of how utterly despicable that their history is towards us. And so they're trying to eradicate that. So, you know, this today, you guys are talking about this stuff, but it's not going to change until you see us on the same level as you see these illegal aliens come in here. They have more rights than we do. They have more people coming out trying to advocate for them people.
Mike, can I ask you a question? This is what I want to ask you about. So, you know, white people and police accountability. Do you think it would be better if all the white people just went swimming and totally ignored this issue and didn't participate and tried to push it all? What do you think white people should do? Just like take a flying leap at a rolling piece of pastry and go back and watch TV? Or should we get involved?
I think white people should deal with themselves, because nothing is going to change until white folks are threatened with police shootings. It's just like when drugs came into the black community. As long as black people was killing themselves, nobody cared. But then when white kids start taking drugs, then they cared. So that's what it's going to take. White people have to become disgusted with a situation in order for it to change the way it is.
So check it out. A lot of the mentally ill people getting shot, I mean, I don't mean to be weird about it, a lot of those people are white. They're not all white. But I do think that there is a place where white, I mean, and I don't even want to debate with you this issue of how ignorant we are as white people. I am ignorant. I learn stuff every day. I love it when you call. I always learn stuff from you, Mike, even though I may disagree with you. But I do think that there is something happening. But I hear you. I take your point. Like, what's changing? And that's what I was literally asking Dan. Like, what's changing? What I hear you saying is, you guys can't change this. Something else has to happen. That's what I hear you saying.
Well, that's right.
All right. All right.
See, Dan is intellectualizing. See, when white folks get involved, they're intellectualizing the situation. It's like academics to them. And so that's why it never changes. Anyway, I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for calling, Mike. I do want to follow up with Mike. I often disagree with what Mike has to say, but I always appreciate his opinion. And Dan, I'm going to let you talk in just a second, but I want to say this about Dan Handelman's work. Portland Cop Watch keeps the public record of the data, the real truth of who the police are killing, who law enforcement is killing, and who is getting in trouble and who's not. Dan Handelman, basically, and a crew of people just went through and found all the factual errors in the state of Oregon's theoretical reporting about use of force. To me, that's not intellectual. Well, it is intellectual, but it's also rubber meets the road stuff. So I just had to say that. Dan, back to you. What do you want to respond to any of that? And you don't have to. I have other questions to ask you, but I always really appreciate what Mike has to say.
Well, I mean, I think that it is unquestionably true that white people don't know what it's like to be a black person in America. This, you know, there's no debate about that. I would disagree with characterizing undocumented people as illegal, and I would not say they have more rights than African Americans do in this country, especially with what the current administration is doing. And as you pointed out, I mean, while a disproportionate number of the people being shot and killed by the police are African American, and I'll talk about the numbers in a second, there are a lot of white people getting shot too. But the problem with in Portland, about 25% of the people being shot and killed are African American. Our city is only 6% black, so that's four times the rate of the population. So that, you know, that is showing you that there's something definitely wrong.
I also want to cut in really quickly and say a lot of our immigrants are black people. And I know people who came over on the Mariel boat lift and they're African descendants. And some of our Salvadoran refugees that were part of the church protection projects in the 80s and 90s, those people also are people of African descent. And some of the Salvadoran refugees that were sheltered in Portland live here now. And they're black people. I just have to say that. Anyway, as we were saying.
So statewide, Oregon, is, as people know, has a very long history of racism. Wouldn't even allow black people to own land here for a long time. And there's only a 2% population of black people in Oregon, but 6% of the people who have been shot by law enforcement here are African-American. So it is definitely disproportionate how African Americans are targeted by police.
The other thing I was going to mention earlier is that years ago we used to have all these ideas about how to do police accountability. We have to get more police from the local community, and we need more police officers who are people of color. And people don't talk about that anymore because I think it was a dead end. What do you think about those ideas from years ago?
Well, you know, I think what we've always said is that you can't just put more people of color into the police bureau unless you're changing the culture at the same time, because then you just end up with people who are
super
going along to get
people
along, and they become part of the institutional racism themselves. So as long as we're working on changing what the policies are and how the training's going. Now, Portland police are actually doing anti-bias training. The new deputy chief, Bob Day, has been in charge of this. Now, he's a white guy, and he suddenly had a light bulb moment, he calls it, when he went to go see a play, Hands Up, that was done about the experience of black people when they're stopped by the police. And so now he's trying to do an anti-bias training within the bureau that'll help people confront their own racism and hopefully deconstruct it and, you know, try to get make it so that it's not just anti-bias training like they have across the boards in city bureaus where they're trying to make sure that people of color working in the city aren't discriminated against, but that it'll also affect how they deal with people out on the street.
Dan Handelman is our guest. We're live on the phone with him. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm sitting in for Cecil and Celeste. This is More Talk Radio. Dan, I want to ask you the hardest question of all. This is the hardest question of the whole day. What the hell's going on with the city of Portland's cockle, cockle, police accountability thing?
Well, we could do a whole hour just on that.
I'm afraid it's true.
You know, as I mentioned before, the compliance officer and community liaison who you're referring to, and I never pronounce it as a word because there's lots of things that we don't, you know, yeah, we do say KBOO, but many things, whether it's an acronym, we don't say it as a word. So I just refuse to say that. So anyway, the compliance officer was hired to make sure that the police are complying with the DOJ agreement that was put in place in late 2012, and their reports come out every quarter now. They went bound to semi-annual to say what's going on. And the most recent one came out and gave the police a green light on everything that has to do with mental health. And we did an analysis showing that they're not correct in their analysis. The community also had a board called the Community Oversight Advisory Board that was supposed to help with those interpretations, like look at those reports from the COCL and tell the public whether or not they agreed, and tell the COCL in order to get them to modify the report before it was finalized. That body kind of imploded, but the city was instrumental in that because they refused to seat people after people started resigning, and it just kind of ended up getting from 15 members down to 5, and they just let it die at the end of January last year, and there's still no replacement. They're just now recruiting people for the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, if you can get around your mind around that term, which is the replacement for the COAB, and that's going to be the deadline to apply is June 1st if people are interested in doing that, and then they are planning to have them trained and seated, I think, by the beginning of August.
Dan, I've noticed
over a year and a half without a community board overseeing this agreement.
I've noticed over the years that you and Portland Cop Watch have been critical, consistently critical of specific aspects of these board operations, but also consistently supportive of the individual human beings that sit on these boards. Can you talk a little bit about who gets on these panels? Who do we wish would apply for these panels? And what should people be doing right now?
My brain right now is focused on this list of deadly force incidents, and I'm, I think that's, again, it's a good conversation for another time.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the list of deadly force incidents, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, can people do anything about it?
About the list of deadly force incidents?
Yes, any part of it.
Well, I think people need to contact the Attorney General's office and say, well, first of all, your list is incomplete. If you want a complete list, use Portland Cop Watch's list. And I would add an asterisk that, though, that there are at least 4 incidents that they have in their database that we didn't have before. So I did learn something from looking at their database. But they have, we talked about before, 42% of the incidents of the people who died are missing. So we need, and they need to correct the narratives. The narratives, we talked about 2 specific narratives, the one about Aaron Campbell, the one about Keaton Nose. But when you look at most of them, and we're not familiar in the same way we are with those cases, with every case that's up there, but a lot of them, the narrative is just the person had a gun, so therefore the police officers killed them. It's kind of this repeating of the narrative of it's okay when a police officer fears for their life to shoot and kill somebody, which I don't think we as a society should tolerate anymore. You know, I think they should be recognizing this kind of what your caller was talking about before. They should be recognizing the humanity of the person who died and the effect that it has not only on that person but their family and their loved ones and the whole community whenever these shootings happen. And that's, I think that was the point of having Senate Bill 111, was to have these presentations by the DA and the police where they have to listen to the community's pain and understand it and hopefully change over time. So, I think that's one of the things that gets lost. And I'm talking about numbers and statistics, sure, but, every one of those people is a human being. And we've worked with a lot of these families, individual families, and it's a very painful thing to do this over and over again. You know, all these parents who say, I'm supposed to outlive my child, and then they don't. And
like Irene Kalonji. Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, and Fred Bryant, and you know, Keaton Otis's dad died from the stress he had from working on justice for his son. And that just recently happened with Eric Garner's sister, who was much younger than Fred Bryant. She died, too, from the stress of working on her brother's case.
Hey, Dan, I want to thank you for being with us today. I think we're going to close out this show, and I really want to direct people to it. Give us your website address and tell us what people can find on there, Dan.
Okay. Our website is portlandcopwatch.org, and we have our letter to the Attorney General is up there. I'm going to try to get the update with the links to the U.S. DOJ site up there later today if I have time, maybe a couple of days before I can get to that. And they can also email us from there if they want to get on our email list. And we have a newsletter that comes out 3 times a year. We have almost every issue that we've ever published for 25 years posted on the website if you want to go back and do some research about things that have happened in the past. There's, you know, we got statistics, we got analysis of the DOJ agreement, we got a list of everybody that's been shot or shot at or killed by the Portland police.
And all the city payouts. Like the city payout amounts.
Yeah, we haven't updated that in a long time. But yes, we do have as of, I think, 2013 or something like that, the highest settlements for shootings and deaths and or any kind of brutality, yes.
Right. All right. So, Dan Handelman, I just want to thank you again for being with us today.
Thanks, Lisa.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. This is More Talk Radio, sitting in for Cecil and Celeste. I'm Lisa Loving. Thanks to Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. That's Portland Cop Watch. Find them online at portlandcopwatch.org. Big thanks to our engineer this morning, my beloved friend and compatriot, Krista Lelinski. And thanks for supporting our humble membership drive. We made our goal, and you did that. Stay tuned for deep political analysis with the Moles. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Tuesday, May 15th marks the 70th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced from their homes for the creation of the State of Israel, creating the largest refugee population on earth, many of whom remain in exile generations later.